Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code LETTHEREBETALK at checkout to get 10% off Squarespace. Build it beautiful. You got to use Squarespace, man. I mean, here's the thing. Building websites is always so ridiculously hard. And then you're paying someone to put it together. And then you want to update it and you got to get a hold of that guy. And he moved to like London and now you can't have him update your podcast or your website. Not your podcast. Oh, I'm out of it. I'm on NyQuil today. Still got a sore throat, head cold. How long does this thing last? Hopefully Squarespace can get rid of my cold. But seriously, Squarespace, man, it's incredible. You can build a website that looks totally pro. There's no skill level needed, no coding required, none of that dumb nerd stuff. It's easy to use. Also, you can get a free domain if you sign up for a year on Squarespace. Start your Squarespace free trial right now at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, God, this stuff is hard to say. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code LETTHEREBETALK to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful. I'm in the middle of building a new website now. I want to be completely in control. That's the only way your website works, is if you're always updating it and keeping it fresh. Make sure you use Squarespace and put in Let There Be Talk at the offer code. All right, here it is. It's, what do we got? January 11th. I'm all spun out on NyQuil. Throat is crazy. Big show announced. I'm going to be 50, and I'm having a huge party February 2nd. If you live in Los Angeles, get your tickets right away because this will sell out. Del Rey at the El Rey. A night at the El Rey Theater. Let me tell you what we're doing. We're going to do comedy and rock and roll. So for the first half of the show, it's going to be Bill Burr, Joe Rogan, Chris D'Elia, Brian Redband, Joe Bartnick, and myself doing stand-up. And then we'll clear the stage, do a little 10-minute intermission, and then come back with a full-blown all-star rock star tribute to Bon Scott. We're going to do some AC/DC. We're going to play the Highway to Hell album in its entirety with some incredible celebrity rock and rollers. Chris Goss will be there for Masters of Reality. Rudy Sarzo on bass. We got Bill Burr's going to play some drums. Josh Z, who was in an incredible band called Protein back in the day, who is Angus Young. Billy Rowe from Jet Boy on rhythm guitar. Ronnie Crawford on drums. He's played with everyone, including myself and my band. And then Dave Lombardo from Slayer and a bunch of other secret jammers. Don't miss it. El Rey Theater, February 2nd, 8 p.m. Get your tickets right away for this. It will sell out. El Rey Theater, Los Angeles. All right. Episode's late today because I went to go see Tool last night with Rory Scovel and my boy Greg at El Cajon Harley. We spun down to San Diego to see Tool and Primus. I'm still got sore throat, but I couldn't miss it. And I gotta tell you, man, wow. I can't fucking believe And I went last year and I said this, and I'm saying it again. I can't fucking believe how insane Tool is. I mean, here's a band I've been seeing since the 90s, and they're fucking selling out arenas still. No new record. Disappeared for years. And just come out and fucking destroy. Just pure art, man. And I gotta tell you, Primus just blew my fucking mind. I hadn't seen Primus since back on the Anthrax. I think it was Anthrax, Public Enemy, Primus tour. I mean, that's how long ago I saw Primus. And they came out, Les Claypool, just destroying, man. And it's funny because I never realized it back in the day, but it was really obvious to me last night how much Devo influenced Primus. It was really, really apparent and really cool. I was like, wow. And Primus, fuck, man, I'll go see them again when they headline. I am in on that, man. They just, an all-around amazing evening. Went down early, got some ramen, hit a record store, picked up the Black Crowes, Three Snakes and a Charm on vinyl, and got a couple great Dead records on vinyl. Anyway, an incredible evening comes to a smashing halt as we step outside and get the news that David Bowie had passed. This is just fucking mind-boggling to me. You know, he just drops a new record. I'm excited. I'm thinking, oh, he's going to go on tour again. I'm going to get to see him. No idea. No idea that he's sick. 18 months cancer. Kept it on the low. And it just fucking floored me. As I rode home in the car, we listened to Bowie all the way home, And I just think back the first time I saw Bowie. I loved Bowie growing up. The first time I saw Bowie was in Petaluma at the, I think it was the Showcase Theater. I went to go see Man That Fell to Earth, that movie. I was young, maybe fifth or sixth grade. And I remember watching the whole thing like, what? That thing sucked. I didn't understand it at all. You know, I was young. I was like, what is that? But I realized a few years later that that film was amazing and actually got me to love like art films. You know, like something didn't need to make sense or be hit over the head with what it was about. And it really set me on a course of cool movies my entire life. And then I see Bowie live in 1983 at the US Festival. My mom loved Bowie. I loved Bowie. I saw him at the US Festival, absolutely destroy. And then my mom and I saw him at the A's Oakland Coliseum where the A's play. Return of the Thin White Duke tour, Let's Dance, China Girl, all that. And I fucking love that record. It was incredible to see him. Of course, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan played on that record. Nile Rodgers produced it. It was an amazing record of hits. Totally different than, of course, his 70s. Ziggy and all that radical stuff, but the songs were amazing. And that's what, at the end of the day, a lot of times I think people don't talk about Bowie's songs. Yeah, they talk about, like, you know, his like craziness and his arty looks and his different stage personas, but I think a lot of times they never talk about the songs. And man, does he have some fucking songs? Gene Genie, Rebel Rebel, Suffragette City, Diamond Dogs, Heroes, The Man Who Sold the World, which was incredibly covered by Nirvana on that Unplugged concert. My favorite, Fame, Golden Years, Young Americans, China Girl, like I said before. What else is he? Let's Dance. I love Let's Dance. Under Pressure. Come on, man. Fashion. Fuck, Fashion is great. Modern Love. Scary Monsters. I mean, come on, man. This fucking guy has a city of hits and incredible songs. Then I saw him with the Tin Machine, which was amazing. And then I saw him once at the Warfield, and I still have the poster for this, where it was a weird night where he DJ'd for an hour and then he played for a couple hours. And that was radical to see him in this small venue. He hadn't been around for a long time, and he poof pops up at the Warfield. I could go on and on about Bowie, you know? It's unbelievable. Unbelievable that he is gone. 69 years old. I mean, how the fuck is cancer still around? It just blows my mind. You know? And I think I'm getting to that age where my heroes are going to start dying. And it's really going to be over, man. Which made me think last night as I saw Tool and Primus, and I've seen some great, great bands in the last year. These bands, you know, they'll carry on. They'll carry the torch. I mean, Maynard, you know he's got some Bowie in him. You know he has Bowie in him. Back to the Perfect Circle with the wigs. And, you know, even last night he was dressed like kind of like a cop in the dark, full art performance. Of course, Maynard has Bowie in him. Everyone has Bowie in him. Anyone that's a glam rocker or an art rocker, Marilyn Manson, he's got Bowie in him. Hell yes. It's just crazy he's gone. I just can't believe it. You know? Scott Weiland? Yeah, we lost him. He worshipped Bowie. He worshipped Bowie. I remember my man Jacob Dylan doing an amazing cover for the, I think it was the Godzilla movie. Wallflowers did Heroes. Loved it. When we were out on the road, they played it every night. Just rocking. Man. Gonna miss you, David Bowie. Big time. Anyway. It's crazy. Rough day. Rough day in music. I want to read a couple great emails I got. And then we'll get to the episode, which, by the way, the episode is fucking fire today. It's Bill Burr and Dave Lombardo. And we talk drums and comedy and life. And I love this episode. We recorded it live last week at the All Things Comedy Studio. And I love both these men. And I'm just so happy that I know them, you know? I'm going to read this first email here. It's from Luca, and I'm going to fuck his last name up. Matozic. Luca Matozic. Hey, Dean, it's Luke. I live in Croatia. That's right. I just said Croatia. That's where this email is coming from, and these emails blow me away and are the reason I love doing this fucking podcast. I don't have Twitter or Facebook, so I wanted to thank you via email. I went through a rough year, had cancer, and did 6 months of chemo, 12 cycles, and you and a couple other podcasters made my life better. All those hours in the hospital or at home sick after therapy, podcasts saved my life and made me go through the day. If you ever come to Croatia, don't be a stranger and keep up the good work. Amazing. Amazing, that fucking email. That just makes this podcast 100% worth it. I love you, brother. And stay strong and keep rocking, you know? I'll read you one more. And I'm just reading these because they were pretty touching. Let's see here. This one comes from Ron Burns. I wanted to thank you for all the amazing guests you have introduced me to on your podcast, as well as Shot Jackets. I've never considered wearing a leather jacket until I heard you talk about them. So thank you so much. You are a real inspiration. And having heard you on Joe Rogan Experience, you've gone to the front of my line and podcast ever since. Thanks for all you do. Stay rad. Another amazing email. Those just make the fucking day. Thank you for the emails. Keep subscribing, people. And play some Bowie today. Leave a review on the podcast. It helps, man. I'm trying to get to 600. What am I at right now? Let me look. I'm at, if you leave reviews, it puts the podcast up in the top 50. That's how this wackiness works. I don't know how that is, but let's see what I'm at. I'm at 463. Trying to get to 500, man. It's easy. People just leave reviews. It takes like 1 second. Like someone left one yesterday. It was Dean Gets It Done, Rock and Roll Till We Die. Boom, that quick. Adam Beefy Cheesy Whiskey. All right, I got to go. I want to get you guys on this episode real quick before you start it up. If you want to donate to the podcast, hit patreon.com/DeanDelRay. Super easy. Leave whatever you want. It helps the podcast. And patreon.com/DeanDelRay. And get those tickets to the El Rey. Del Rey at the El Rey. Light the candles. Happy Monday. Keep it going, Bowie. Love you. Hey, what's happening? We got another episode of Let There Be Talk here. This is Let There Be Drum Talk today. We have Bill Burr and Dave Lombardo. Bill and I did one about 2 years ago with Brian Tichy. Where we just
that
talked.
That was not 2 years ago.
It wasn't? What do you think?
Oh, I thought you definitely knew. That felt like maybe, please say it was a year and a half, man. By two. That was like 10 years ago.
I think it was 2 years ago, man. I don't know, but it was very popular show. We talked Bonzo, and then, of course, Dave Lombardo being one of my favorite drummers ever, the king of the double bass pedal. First time I saw you, Slayer, just blew my mind. Like, what? That's got to be fake. You know, like, like, wow. And you're not even sweating when you play.
Yeah, it's just you're used to it. You're conditioned, and, you know, you build up your stamina. You know, it's like a runner, you know, if you take on, a marathon, you're not going to be able to do 5 miles, you know, off the bat. You have to build.
Right.
And that's exactly.
I never had the discipline to learn how to, I became obsessed with Bonham, and I was like, until I can play Good Times, Bad Times with one pedal, I'm not going to mess with, and then I never got to the Good Times, Bad Times thing, and I never did the double pedal. One time I tried playing out with one, and we did a Pantera song, and I sort of, but it was sort of, was that Cowboys from Hell, so it wasn't too fast, but I still fucked the whole thing up, especially towards the end of the song. But I think you guys, like, you guys, all the double bass drum players, man, are fucking amazing. It's amazing to me.
I think it's the coolest sounding drums, especially back in the day, you know, like when you got into the early Slayer, it was so fucking fast. And you would just hear this double bass, and it would be perfect, man. It sounded like a Harley, you know?
There was no click. We did not follow a metronome, you know, during those sessions, and we recorded on a tape. So it wasn't like today, but, you know, we have computers fixing all the little drum parts and everything. Everything's, you know.
Well, I just love that there was nobody as fast as your band, so you had to learn, like, anybody can, like I find, like, on YouTube, like, well, there was no YouTube back there either, but you can, if someone can always break down what somebody did, but I'm always amazed, like, the first guy, but everyone was just like, oh my God, Lars, Metallica, like, this is the fastest feat ever, and then you guys came, was it 86?
With Rain and Blood.
Yeah. And I was just like, oh my, a whole other level.
Yeah.
So you might, what were you thinking when you guys were playing at that tempo? You must have been the fastest guy around out there. Not to just, I know there was music going on, but still, just the blinding speed was ridiculous.
Yeah, I feel we were the fastest. Nobody else, you know, could compare to us at that time. And if anybody tried, it was like, it's not there. You know?
So how did you develop a technique to go faster than anybody had?
You start off slow. You know, the songs start off at a pace where, or at a tempo that you could work at.
Right.
Know? And then as you learn the song and get it and everybody's, you know, and you perform live, you know, your adrenaline kicks in. So the song becomes faster. And then faster. Jeez. Because they had no limitations. You know, we could just play.
So you're basically saying just sit down for 1,000 hours and you get it.
Yeah,
I always
exactly.
want the shortcut. Is there like a technique, a slide thing can be doing? No, you got to sit there.
That's what people always ask me. How'd you get in at that place? The work. And then they walk on. They don't want to hear that. The thing I love about your playing is it's not necessarily how fast it is. It's super fast, but it grooves. Because a lot of guys can play like, but there's no groove. You guys had this insane groove going, you know?
Well, I listened to Zeppelin
and
Bonham, which we've talked about before. It's one of my favorite drummers. And, you know, you listen to those songs, there's so much swing and so much groove. You know, I picked up on it. And also the music I used to listen to when I was a kid. You know, I listened to a lot of Latin jazz and percussive-like music from Cuba.
Mm-hmm. You're Cuban, right?
Yeah, I was born, and I came to the States when I was 2. You know, you just pick up on this groove and this rhythm, and I kind of applied it to rock and roll. Because I was fascinated with rock music, you know, here in America. My parents would listen to Cuban music, but then when I was on my own or in my bedroom, I'd listen to KLOS and KMET. And
who was the bands? Were you listening to punk or rock?
Growing up, when I was like 15, 16, I'd listen to, of course, Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, Foreigner. I was into Heart. Whatever was on the radio at that time.
Yes, you know, classic
and was classic rock, you know, the hard stuff. This was what I liked the most. There was one time on the radio station I heard the Wonton Song by Zeppelin, which was a song I never heard before. And I was like, wow, that's heavy. And I remember going through my friend's albums and trying to find that song. It's like, I'm looking for a song by Zeppelin, and I don't know what album it's off of. And I was just searching, you know, frantically searching for this song because I felt it was amazing. It was hard. It was powerful.
Yeah.
All that kind of music, you know, the kind of music that was more powerful and driven were the songs that I liked, that I would always search for. I would never I enjoyed the Rain song, but it's not something I was like passionate about. You know, it's like, oh, that sounds cool.
I think all drummers that can groove somehow always had some sort of jazz background. And that's why I think there was so many of those kinds of players like coming out of the 50s and 60s, because the music before it was big band into bebop, and all of them at least listened to their parents' records, so they had that swing pulse in them. So then when they applied it to rock, it still grooved. And then I think like my generation came along, and ours was the misinterpretation of Bonham, where it was just like, you just fucking swing from behind your ears, and like that's how you get like this big sound. And it just became this really like, I don't know, if you watch, you know, white people always get shit for having no rhythm. If you watch white people, if you listen to live records, like somewhere in the 60s, we lost it. Like in big band swing, it was impossible not to like clap on 2 and 4. It was just so heavy that you knew where it was. But somewhere around there, it became the clapping on all 4 beats. And then it went to clapping on 1 and 3. But if you look at shit from like the 1950s, where it's 1, 2, 3 o'clock, they were clapping on the beat. Or you watch, I watched something with the Dave Brubeck band, and they go, look at all those white people, they're all on time, this is amazing. And then somewhere around dun 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 dun, it all just became
like, where's that at?
It all just kind of came it just became like this falling down the stairs kind of thing. So I've always said, and that was something that like one of the hardest things that I had with like speed metal and everything was it was so fast that if there wasn't a groove, I just couldn't get into it. And my brother got really into that, a lot of that type of stuff. And I sort of stayed back, and I liked Metallica. I'm so bad with the names of the
song. The song?
No, what's their classic with that? Dun, 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 dun.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, Master of Puppets.
Yes,
yeah.
So the fucking, when they go into the verse, the fucking guitar rhythm in that is so fucking sick. It gives me chills every time, except they chop off that 1/8 note that always destroys me. It's like, why don't you just fucking keep it going, man? That was killer.
Played with Metallica.
Oh, I know, yeah. I remember seeing that on the, I Miss Everything. I found out about that like a year after you did. I was like, what the fuck? I would have loved to have seen that. But like, I always like was into bands, like if they didn't have that, that I just couldn't. Yeah. It was just this wall. It was amazing what they were doing, but if there wasn't that groove there, if there wasn't anything that gave me the chills, I could never get into that. But when I finally sat down, because the first time I was going to like from like hair metal to you guys, so it was you guys were like light years beyond what I was listening to. So I had to come back to you guys like 10 years after that came out, and I was just like, oh my god, this is fucking unbelievable. So I was way behind on all of that stuff.
I think really the spotlight on Double Bass was probably the one video by Metallica. Remember when they go into that? Landmine has taken my sight. They really closed up on his feet.
Yeah.
They
showed MTV.
They showed you
that was the Ringo on the Ed Sullivan Show for double bass players.
Yeah.
And they finally showed it. Like he's fucking doing that. That's unreal.
That's what that was, man. Right? It's like, Ringo. Whoa.
Just as far as the amount of double bass players that probably like inspired. You know, I know people give Lars a lot of shit. The guy, he basically, I don't understand why he gets so much shit. That guy fucking, like, there was no roadmap to that style of music.
It's true.
No,
I agree with you.
And all the stuff that you were doing, like, no one's gone faster than your band, and now you're the drummer in the band, and you got to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I thought it took a long time for your guys' genre of music to get respect. Even from, like, a guy like me, forget about critics. Like, I was just kind of like, it's too fast. They're yelling. I don't understand what's going on. And then I was listening to, like, Britney Fox, Girl School.
No,
I got a...
Girl School!
Oh, I got some...
They were the third Aerosmith. So you had Aerosmith, then you had Cinderella, then you had Britney Fox.
It kept getting more and more watered. It was like drugs that were stepped on.
Yeah, that's what it was.
All I think was left was just a mic stand with handkerchiefs hanging off of it would be like the fourth one. But yeah, I listened to, they weren't all bad, but I listened to some, I let a lot of great shows. Like I was old enough that I could have saw you guys in your first tour and I didn't. Bad move.
Yeah. Yeah, and those bands just created more anger within Slayer.
Yeah, because they were an LA band and they were like around while all the glam was hitting on Sunset Strip. And where were you guys playing, you know?
We were playing in Orange County.
Yeah. Was that where the metal scene was?
Not really metal, more of the punk scene.
Right, like Circle Jerks and stuff like that.
Yeah, D.I., Adolescence, and... So we were playing the clubs there. I mean, I think we played Gazzari's one time.
One time.
And we never returned. We would never step foot at the Rainbow.
Yeah.
Because how was the
reaction when you played Gazzari's?
I think there was probably three or four other bands playing that night. I honestly don't remember, but I remember we got out of there pretty quick. Because some of the bands that were there, you know, we were playing covers, but we were playing Iron Maiden.
Oh, you're playing covers?
At that time.
Yeah. Oh,
this was
okay.
Early. We played the Troubadour. Those are the only two clubs in LA we played.
At what point did you realize that Sunset's, like, that scene was not going to be right for you guys? Was it just the lack of gigs, or was it something that you guys...
Our style in general, I mean, we weren't into dressing like...
Women.
Chicks. We weren't into that. I mean, the furthest we went was adding eyeliner, which is on the first album.
Yeah.
You know, pictures of us wearing eyeliner.
And, but that's also could go evil, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And we took that from Ozzy.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And we felt that we did not belong in that genre at all. And so we went heavier. We went punk. We went, aggressive. Instead of puckering our lips, you know, we flipped people off, threw beer cans and, you know, raised hell.
But Bill was recently, we were talking about the drummer for Rush, and he's retiring because he has carpal tunnel. And Bill said he saw at one point he went back to traditional grip. And I remember when I had you on the podcast before, you really talked about your body does not swing like a Tommy Lee fucking hey guy. You're really right here. You know, you're like right here. So your body, you said your sockets don't get worn out and stuff, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think I've mastered the ergonomics of my drum set where I don't have to reach far for anything and for any of the cymbals or any of the toms. And I think that's saved, you know, my joints. And right now I'm still, you know, pain free.
Really?
Yeah, still.
That's incredible.
I'm really happy about it. Real fortunate because I hear a lot of, you know, stories from drummers that are, you know, having carpal tunnel syndrome and needing surgery. And, you know, I couldn't even, you know, imagine the pain that those guys go through. You know, every now and then I do have maybe muscle aches, but that's normal, you know, if you haven't played for a while, you know, so.
Yeah, I've never seen some drummer in like a really pop band, he just couldn't do it anymore. Like his shoulders were worn out. And that was like this guy played arenas and he was playing to the back of the house and he was, I don't know what he was doing, but like I heard he just wore out his shoulders and it was just like bone on bone and I was just like playing that. So.
You know, I would look at that and look at his drum set and say, okay, that cymbal's, you know, too high or you know, this crash or this china, you need to bring these toms down. You know, I would look at it from a different perspective. And some of these guys, they don't know.
You
know?
Do you remember the early 80s when the cool thing was to have your ride cymbal like three stories up?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd just be reaching up. I remember Steve Jordan had his, when he used to play in Letterman, he had his up there. Omar Hakim had his way up there. And I was just like, I remember like trying to like raise up the thing. And I would literally be like playing a song and all the blood is like going down your shoulder. It's like my arm's falling asleep.
It's like the ape hangers of cymbals. You know?
Oh, yes.
I've never understood how you can ride a motorcycle like that, Dean. With the what do you call them? Ape arms?
Ape hangers, yeah. It's incredible because it's way more comfortable.
Really?
It's really weird because your arms rest on it and there's a weird flow to it. Down here, when you're riding and your bars are down here, you start to get neck pinch. Where this is like your arms and everything's looking straight. And then it's a night and
what
day.
About the blood? The blood's not like...
No, it doesn't do anything. It's crazy. Like, it seems like the old... Once I rode like that, I was like, I'm never going back. But, like, the neck pinch was gone. You know, your shit's down here. Also, when you're here, you can really fly between the cars. You can see good.
Wow.
You know, you can kind of see them. All right, I can see what's going on here. They're like
now, you're back to riding.
Yeah.
Right? This maniac, did you see him during that time when he got his whole side of him looked... Dude, he looked like he went through a cheese grater.
Oh.
His whole side, up and down, up and down.
Fucking some lady hit me, man, doing 70 on the 110 freeway.
No.
Just insane. Bill saved me. Came over and brought me a pie.
Some t-shirts are like quadruple X t-shirts that wouldn't touch his entire... Like, dude.
Yeah.
He like high-sided the bike and just... like you're probably going like what? How fast were you going? Like
I was doing about 55 or so because I was just getting ready to go in the tunnel. Wow. So I slowed down because my eyes change slow in dark, you know, tunnels. So I just kind of slowed down. There was no one on the road. And so I was doing like 55. So she was easily doing 70 because the amount of speed that she hit me, I was just riding. I went, what is that? I was down.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. You know, it's weird though. It's like.
So then he got a car and he's just like 35 years of riding, man. Yeah. You know, I'm lucky I walked away, but blah, 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 blah. Hobbling around, dude, like someone who got thrown off a bike doing 55. And then like 6 weeks later, you're like, nah, I'm riding again. But you did get a car, though.
I did get a car, yeah. And I just drove the car to the Bay Area. And, you know, I got the satellite radio on. And I'm just driving up to the punchline.
And all the metal surrounding you.
Yeah.
Airbags.
Yeah. I had heated seats. It was really cold. It was like 31 degrees. A heated seat. All right. And I was just in my own world. Like, this is great, you know?
Yeah. Then you don't notice people on motorcycles. That's what happens.
Yeah.
You join this side. The last time I ever rode, I rode with him. And I always wanted to ride all the way down to Sunset to the ocean and come back. And I was fucking riding on the way out there. and I was going around like a turn that went to the left, and somebody on the other side was coming around, and they went a little over the double line, and like my head was lined up with the side of their fucking car, and I had to come up and then go back into it, so I didn't come out of turn. Dude, I got off the bike when we went to get gas.
Yeah,
and
at
I
the shut 76. It off.
I was shaking, and I thought it was the vibration of the bike. And when I was sitting down and I was trying to drink my Coke and I was still doing that, I was like, all right, this is.
He looked at me and goes, I'm done.
Yeah.
He just said, I'm done. I was glad he was done because everybody kept saying, man, you're going to kill Bill Burr, man. That's not cool, man. Tell him not to ride, dude. He's big. He's blowing up in his career. Uh-huh. And you're like, I'm the guy out there with the drugs. Get right. on this heroin. You know what I mean? I'm like, it ain't me, man. Yeah. It ain't me. I don't want him to ride.
Yeah. That shit's scary. I had an accident back in 2004. I was
you ride?
Riding, dirt bikes, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I was really into dirt bikes and motocross. I was going to all the shows, everything. And I bought my kids. I had two boys. And I bought them a little 80 and a little 100. And I had a 250. And we went to Dumont Dunes, you know, where that's at, off the 15 going up to Vegas. And I was riding, having a great time. You know, they gave me some warnings, you know, be careful. There's these razorback sand dunes, you know, they're a gradual climb, but then it cuts off at the end.
Oh, oh shit.
Yeah. Yep.
And how high was it?
About 65 feet, 65, 70 feet. And I miscalculated, and they told me to go along the edge and look down to see if you can drop down. Well, I miscalculated, and the edge came too soon. And next thing you know, I'm midair.
Whoa.
And I see all the, you know, the RVs and the campers are about this small. And I'm like, oh, shit, here I go. Bam. And then I hit the sand and crushed the side of my skull down to the right. And
With the helmet on?
With the helmet. I had all the gear.
You have to worry about your spine coming down like that with no ramp or anything.
Yeah, nothing. And, you know, the sand, you know, you'll fall in, but then it just, you know.
Yeah, the rock hard underneath it.
It's just rock hard. And what caused the damage on my skull were the goggles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I hit the crossbar.
Oh.
I didn't, you know, brace myself. I hit the crossbar and crushed the side of my face. So I was like, oh, I need to blow my nose. And something didn't feel right because my jaw didn't close.
I was like,
oh, fuck, I need to blow my nose. And next thing you know, I blew my nose and my nasal cavity was cracked.
No! Yeah.
And it just blew up. It's a poof. They go, Dave, you need to lay down. We need to call the paramedics.
Whoa.
I was like, I'm okay. They wanted to airlift me, but there was no spinal injury. There was nothing. I was able to walk away.
Oh, God.
Was that it for you on riding?
No. I got back on the bike a week later.
Yeah. I think that's the difference. That's the difference between a lifetime rider and some of those. Yeah. I had one of those close calls, and that was it. I do miss it, but, like, if I was ever going to do it, like, I would want to be in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Like Wyoming on a long road, no one around.
Yeah. I never went back to
Bill and I went dirt bike riding.
Dirt bike is great. Trail riding.
That was fun. I fell down when I was doing that. But, you know, I fell in the dirt. And I was going, like, you know, half a mile an hour. Yeah. I had all this shit on. That was fine. But just, I could never get past just riding down the road. And there'd be a car next to me. And you just think, if they don't see me right now and they just come over here, I'm going to be underneath that car.
Yeah. Yeah.
And God willing, I'll die instantly instead of getting dragged down the fucking street. Stop!
I'm on your bumper.
Yeah.
Oh, I tell you, I still hear the sound. That's the thing that trips me out. I still hear the sound. Because it was so weird. Well, I remember I told Bill, as I was sliding down the highway, I just thought, well, I got no regrets. You know? Mm. I had no regrets. It was like fucking amazing life.
I got back on the bike after a while, you know? But I've sold them and I haven't ridden. So
were you playing at Slayer at the time?
Yeah.
And you went out with like a busted up cheat or were you guys off?
Actually, I had some shows with Fantomas and Mike Patton.
Yeah.
And I went on stage and, you know, I had the stitches and everything was all screwed up. And
He said, "Dude, you need a pirate's patch."
I said, "Yeah, that fits in,
yeah,
man.
It would fit in perfect." You know?
Mike Patton just lunatic.
He said, "Dude, get a pirate patch, you know, an eye patch." I said, "All right."
Hey, what's the worst thing that happened, like technically, on your drum kit, like during a big gig? Like big gig, you're gonna be on TV, and like a bass drum head breaks or something. And...
Well, it's similar. My first hit, it's a. Count four, one, two, three, four, da 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 da, bump, crack. That my beater on the bass drum just snaps, and I have to go into a double bass section, you know, immediately. So I just sat there and I couldn't play. So my tech came up and pulled the pedal out, put another one in, and I resumed.
And the band's still just playing the song.
Yeah, you just keep going. Yeah, this was a live festival. It was
how
a
many
festival.
People were there?
Festivals, probably 30, 50,000 people. For all they know, I mean, it was probably a microphone that went out or something.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't, you know, make a big deal out of it. I just kept on
going.
So
how the fuck does that guy change it and then tune it up so it sounds good? You don't have any time to do
sound
check.
Well, it was the beater that snapped.
The actual
beater,
bro.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it was the beater. So we were able to replace, it was either the pedal, the entire pedal, or just the beater. I think it was the entire pedal. With a drum head, I don't know. We tried to make sure, you know, we change our drum heads, right, you know, frequently so it doesn't happen.
At what level do you have to get where they have all the extra shit? Like at the gig, like
backup
early
kit.
In your career, if you broke that thing, you were fucked. You had to grab the other bass drum pedal and just be like, "All right, playing single bass the rest of the night."
Wow, did that ever happen? Like your shit break down, like the double bass pedal, the chain.
I never used
like
a double bass pedal.
Oh no,
I always used a double bass,
right?
Double bass drum. I mean, there were times where I think I had an extra pedal. And I just put it on myself.
Yeah.
You know, there's been times where I've broken snare drums and you just keep playing. You know, you just keep hitting them until, you know, you have time to change it. That's when you're working by yourself. But if you have somebody helping you out, they immediately change it for you.
That's my favorite scene in Let There Be Rock, the movie. They're playing and his snare drum breaks. And he's just keeping time on the hi-hat. And you see the guy change it.
Yeah.
And he's smoking a cigarette at the same time. And
oh,
then,
just that guy, nothing rattles him.
Nothing. Yeah. And then it's on and he's like, dan and da dan and dan and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's all. You said you like Phil Redd a lot, right?
Yeah, I do. I do. That guy has a really good swing and style. Whereas there was one guy that took his place for a while, I think.
Simon Wright?
No, not Simon.
Oh, the bald guy?
Yeah, yeah.
He's in it now. What's his name?
Chris Slade.
Yeah, Chris Slade from The Firm.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't, you know, my apologies, you know. Yeah, if word gets out to him, I'm just not a fan.
Right.
You know, but Phil Rudd, yeah, he's amazing. He has really good swing and amazing time. He's like the perfect fit for that band.
Yeah.
Who starts doing meth in your 60s? It's just fucking
unbelievable. What's going on with that?
I was so psyched when he came back because that was my band. And by the time I got into him, I saw the Simon Wright, Angus Malcolm Cliff, and Brian version of it. And then I saw when he finally came back, I don't know, 13 years later, whatever. It wasn't until the Black Ice tour that I finally saw him. I got to be like, I'm finally getting to see him. You know, he had the cigarette going, the fucking glasses and stuff. He was so cool. And to see him getting booted again. Like, I was so, there was two big like guys getting kicked out of bands, drummers that fucking crushed me when I was coming up. And it was Phil Rudd the first time after the Flick of the Switch recording when he got bounced.
Yeah.
And Steven Adler.
Oh, yeah.
When he got kicked out of Guns N' Roses. I was like, oh, man. Because that guy came along. I've talked about this a million times. I just love, there was so many guys in those hair metal bands that would have like these giant double bass kits, and they were just playing 4/4, and then they would just have the double bass for the solo,
for the logos,
or some of them didn't even have a pedal behind the other one. It was just
it
the
just
look
good, yeah.
Yeah, and then you could have like the band, you know, if your band was the whatever, you know, or you could just, even just was just one word, you could have it on both sides, and they'd have two rack, two floor toms, the double chinas, a gong behind them, and all they were playing was this 2/4 shit. And then he came along, and he had a little 4-piece kit with the ride, you know, where that second tom would be, the second rack tom would be. And it was just the coolest setup, and he was using all of it, you know, like an appetite. Was it Welcome to the Jungle? He's got the floor tom pattern. He's got the cowbell thing before Will Ferrell in that sketch killed cowbell forever.
But that part where it's like dun 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 dun. I mean, that's a hard fucking part to play. People don't realize it, but you put 10 drummers on there, and it's not going to feel the same as Adler.
And it's just really musical too. I just thought he was really musical. Where he hit crash cymbals, when he didn't. And he just, like, you could just tell this guy's really thinking this through. And then also he has the gift. And I just thought the way he played, he had this weird thing where it was laid back, but he was like on the front of the beat. It was like a punk kind of thing, but also laid back. I loved his fucking playing. And when he got kicked out, I was devastated. I was, you know, I was a young kid, so I was like, you know, fuck the band. It's not the same band anymore. But of course, when Use Your Illusions came out, you know, I was all over it. But I was devastated when that happened.
So what drummer is going to be coming back?
We don't know yet. No? That's what's crazy. It's like, here's what
I'm just psyched they're finally going to do. I was thinking, like, man, they got like. Like, it was one of those, like, things, like, if they don't do that in the next couple of years, that's never going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, Axl can only probably sing that for so much longer, you know what I mean?
I thought his voice was still pretty good.
It was great. I'm just saying, if you waited 5 more years, like, I saw him last year. It's funny because Twitter lights up, you know, and they're like, ah, fuck them, no Izzy, no Adler, no me, and all this dumb shit.
Yeah, nobody cares.
Yeah, it's like, what are you talking
I'll take your ticket.
Yeah, what are you talking about? But I saw, and then they said, oh, Axl sounds terrible now. None of these people, I don't even think, go to the shows or anything. I saw him at the Palladium last year. Played like 4 nights. He fucking sounded great. And I remember exactly, I was telling Burr this, that he said, look, I can sing everything exactly the same, but Rocket Queen is hard as fuck. And when you think about it, that is so high when it starts out. It's like, I got everything imaginable right before my eyes. It's so high, you know?
Well, maybe you should sing it.
Yeah, that's what I hit him up on Twitter. I said, hey, man, I'll be that guy up there in the right corner, you know?
Yeah!
But, I mean, you know, he was supposed to be on Kimmel tonight. And then he canceled. Now, I don't know. The inside on me says he probably didn't get these contracts signed with the other members yet. You know, there's some contracts. Mm-hmm. Sign this. This is what you're making. Like, say, the other guys. And maybe they didn't get him signed yet. Yeah. And he's like, well, I can't go on and announce the lineup yet. The weekend, the lawyers say, wait, what's this or whatever. I don't know. That's what I think.
Probably.
But, yeah, but, you know, so far it's Duff.
Just hope it happens.
Yeah, right? Exactly. It's Duff, Slash, and Axl so far.
And let's hope that Axl, you know, makes it to the stage.
Well, you know, in the last 3 years, he stopped going late and everything. And they warned you. They emailed you like, hey, he doesn't go on late anymore. You used to get an email from Ticketmaster. He's on right at time, maybe 10 minutes off.
Cool.
I went to the Palladium. That fucker was on spot on 4 minutes late. I was like, yeah.
Perfect.
And people were ready, you know, like, oh, he's going to be on time. You know, so that's.
Well, I always heard, you know, if you go over all those union charges, you'll come off tour and owe money.
Yeah.
If you're not careful enough. If I remember correctly, in one of their books, Slash's book or something, he was talking about that, or maybe Adler's book. I can't remember. So one of their books was saying that they ended up having to, after they finished a big tour, they had to go back out on another tour because they didn't make any money because of the giant production and, you know, going on late and all the overages and all of that type of shit.
Yeah, it's triple time. Like, you just did The Garden and... you know, you go over, it's triple time immediately for those green coats, you know, and the fucking, that's insane, man. Burr did The Garden.
I didn't realize that's triple time?
Triple time.
Triple, yeah.
It's not even double. It's like, why is it triple all of a sudden?
I asked them, I said, what time do I have to be off by? They were like 10:30, so I went to 10:28. Like, I almost did an hour and a half. Like, I wasn't going to get off because it's like.
You said it was the show of your life, right?
It went perfectly as far as just being such a big thing and I went on and I was on. I started riffing and it just never. Sometimes you come out and you're killing it and then you almost can't follow what you did and then you get psychologically fucked up by that and it kind of kills the rest of the show. But this was just one of those nights. Everything went went great and you know what was cool is we set up during the day. You know, paid for the place the whole day. I rented a drum kit and some amps. And me and my friends came down in an empty Madison Square Garden. Just played all these fucking songs. Oh, yeah.
It's awesome.
But what was cool is it kind of got over the nervousness of being there and the whole, you know, I'm not worthy and all that, just to go in there and make a bunch of noise and make an ass of myself.
Treat
you know,
it like a fucking playground.
Yeah, a clubhouse. Then it just, it, when I came out, it almost felt like I was doing the second show and it was just the first show. So I did record just the audio that night because I just think stand-up specials look stupid there.
Yeah.
When you, in those giant arenas, it's like there's a comedian then like a 200-foot curtain behind him. It just, he always seems really small. And like, I just think comedy's more of an intimate thing. And but I did want to document it, so I think I'm going to do another vinyl thing, and
that's
I'm
going to
put out all 90 minutes, the double vinyl that opens up like in the old days. I'm going to lose a ton of money.
Yeah.
It's going to be for like total nerds.
Remains the same. Now that was one of the reasons you wanted to jam in there. What'd you call? You called the special something, right?
does anybody remember laughter?
Yeah.
Which is the Robert Plant thing that he said.
Yeah.
And it kind of worked on two levels, where it was a nod to him, and then also with, you know, all the political correctness of, like, you know, I'll just, you know, the over-exaggeration of how many people get offended, which is what it totally is. I mean, you do show after show after show, and nobody gives a shit. And then one person raises a stink, and then they put them on TV like they represented the crust. Like, they fucking stood, half of them stood up that night. This is just one asshole, right? Yeah. So, yeah, it kind of, the whole thing worked out. We were going to do, like, for the poster, put my head over a Plant thing, but I was just like, I'll probably get sued. it's already too on the nose. So, but it was definitely good time. So
that had to be the highlight, right? I mean, you ever play the Garden?
Yes, three times.
Once
with Slayer and two times with Phantomas.
Oh wow!
Opening for Tool.
Oh wow!
That
Tool.
Was epic. Because of course Bonham's, you know, he played on that stage.
I just kept looking at the ceiling.
Me too.
Yeah,
it's all wood. You got the wood slats.
Yeah,
you
know? Because they redid, they gave it a facelift, but they kept that. Like, to me, the roof is like iconic. And there's that one shot in Song Remains the Same where they just cut to the crowd. It's just a sea of hair and people not knowing how to grow long hair. So it's just it's as out as it is long. But you actually see like the roof.
The roof. Yeah.
It's funny. A lot of the theaters that I want to play always goes back to music, to like guys that I saw playing there. And
that's cool.
And I've always looked them up. It's a great thing about the internet. Like where AC/DC played for the Let There Be Rock, the thing they made right before Bond died.
Oh yeah, Let There Be Rock.
Let
There
Be Rock. That was I looked
in
that
Paris?
Place. No, it was a place in Scotland.
Oh wow.
And I think that's where they recorded the live album.
That's right.
You're right. They were in Paris. Yeah. The live album,
If You Want Blood,
was done in this theater in Scotland. I want to say Glasgow or Edinburgh, and I found out that it was knocked down. I was so bummed out. I was like, "Oh man, I want to play that place."
That fucking record is I think it's the best AC/DC record. To me, back in the day, it was the live records that really got you going. It was the Frampton, it was the Cheap Trick live at
Ted
Budokan.
Nugent.
Ted Nugent. We talked about Double Live Gonzo and the AC/DC. If You Want Blood,
dude. Even Bob Seger had a decent.
It was fucking great.
He had a great one. Recorded in Boston Garden and in. Detroit,
yeah, man. That all the live records were great. You know, you did a live record, right? Which one did you guys do a live record?
We did one in Lakeland, Florida.
Lakeland, Florida.
Some arena there. Wow. Clash of the Titans, I believe.
Oh, that was a great tour. Who was on that? Alice in Chains.
Anthrax. Alice in Chains, Anthrax, Megadeth. Yeah.
Yeah. Fuck.
The
I
original
saw that tour.
Yeah, the original.
Cow
Clash
Palace, of the I think it was, or Oakland, one of the two.
Cow Palace.
Yeah.
Any drummers nowadays that you're watching that
Yeah, you watch guys on YouTube?
Bands? I mean, there's some amazing drummers out there. I saw, you know, there's Minel Symbols. They were featuring a drummer, and right now I don't remember his name, but it came up on my news feed. This guy was soloing over these tracks, and he was just amazing.
Yeah.
There's so many great drummers out there. You know, I don't think a lot of them get enough, you know, media attention, or they're just not in bands that are doing anything. There's some hardcore drummers I like. Gabe Serbian, who is the singer of my new band now, but he has another band called Head Wound City, and he played in a band called The Locust. Mm-hmm. Very short songs. The titles of the songs are longer, you know, than the songs.
to read than
the actual songs. And he's really fast, tight. He's got great technique.
But that's the thing now. Don't you think that with kids today, it's like you could literally, as a kid, you could go on YouTube and in one night you could learn or and watch like what it took me 4 years of drum of going every Saturday. Like they would just teach you, here's a paradiddle and don't have your pinky sticking out. All right, see you next Saturday. I mean, it was a little more involved than that, but like you could sit there like the first time I fucked up my foot was trying to figure out how to do those fast doubles, and I had no idea how to do it. And I was doing something where I was like trying to do it with my big toe at the top of the thing, and I was arching my thing, and I got like plantar fasciitis and stuff. I had no idea. And then it wasn't until like YouTube came out. It's like, oh, you just do like a slide kind of thing. It's like, oh, that's all it is? Oh, all right, I'm an idiot. But the kids now can see that as opposed to having to slow a record down or, you know, listen to it 1,000 times with your ear up to it. And it just causes them to like, you know, like, there's kids out there now just putting out, you know, drum solos that they filmed, and they're like in their teens, and it's at the same level of guys when I first started buying instructional DVDs in like the late 80s.
Yeah,
it's
like Bozio.
Yeah, it's like if this guy could go back in town, he could fucking put this out and people would buy this, and he's just some kid in his parents' house. So I'm blown away by what the younger kids are playing now.
Now, yeah, Bill, I agree. You played drums first before you were a comedian. Did you want to actually be in a band? You were in a band with your brother or something? What was going on?
What happened was I was working in a warehouse. My dad was like had music forced upon him.
Yeah.
He can play piano, can play saxophone, just play by ear. And but it was really forced on him, so it kind of killed the thing. Oh, yeah. So I think with him, he didn't want it to force it on us. So he had like a banjo and an accordion, had all this stuff laying around the house. And it wasn't until I started working in a warehouse. I came from real jock town, and then there was like a couple towns over in Walpole. There was a lot of people that played, and these guys showed up, and they were all in a band. I went out to see him, and I was like, it's fucking cool, and he could play the songs on the radio. I was like, he can learn how to do that. So I started with guitar, and I got frustrated really quickly, and then I just switched to drums because I had more of an athletic upbringing and then the physicality of it, and then I just fell in love with them, and then I discovered Bonham and all these guys, and...
Did you play in any bands, though?
I was more the jam house. Like, two of my brothers played guitar, so... And you weren't going to... I mean, I had... You know, I was going to lug my drums around. I didn't have cases or anything like that. So it was just... When my parents went around, kids would just come over. And all these songs that I'm playing now, all the fucking Guns N' Roses stuff, all the AC/DC stuff, a little bit of Metallica. We always had to be... Because I couldn't play double bass. I had to figure out a way to, like... and I couldn't afford a pedal. you know, I had to fake playing it, but... Yes, but I think at one point I understood that I didn't have the gift. I understood that the best, like if I really dedicated myself, I could be a really solid drummer in a really good cover band.
Right.
Like I can ape what somebody already did.
Yeah, right, but you're not coming
but
up
like,
with shit.
But like, yeah, to be the guy that like came up with it, which is why, Dave, I hold you the way at the level that I do, because there was no roadmap where all of a sudden it's like, all right, now we're going to be faster than anything else out there, and it's still got a groove. All right, now you got to figure out how to do it. And I was one of those people that, after you did it and then an instructor broke it down, then I could like figure out how to do it. Like I just, you know, I still to this day, you know, wish I had more of a gift, but I think it worked out. But there is those times when I go into Guitar Center and I'll just see some 8-year-old who just has it.
Yeah.
And he's already, his phrasing is already, I'm just like, oh, this kid's good. He's going to be better than me by October. This is fucking brutal. But it's definitely like, it's a hobby that I definitely, it's just, it's fucking awesome.
Yeah, but you're fucking good, man. I mean, you know. Like we
for a comedian, I'm not bad.
Well, you got.
That's not really saying anything. Well, but for a stand-up comic, I'm not bad.
I think what people don't understand about drums is meter, it's timing, and you got it, of course, from being a comedian and stuff. But
people, that's a myth that they go. Do you think because you played drums that affected your comedic timing? It's like two completely same principle, but totally.
I understand
totally
timing
different.
From playing music into the comedy world. I know not to stomp on the drums, which is kind of like don't go into the verse too soon or the pre-chorus or whatever. That's what I'm talking
pacing,
about.
Pacing, but like...
Pacing, yeah.
But someone could play in a band for fucking 50 years. If they're not funny, they're not funny.
Oh, of course not. Of course
not. You know?
Not.
And I've seen plenty of interviews of unbelievable musicians in the interview. They're just kind of like, well, you know, I kind of... Just was an idea I had, and I was, you know, it's just like no personality, no nothing, not even remotely funny. So I think it's, and then I've seen like musicians out there who are fucking hilarious.
Oh yeah, Jacob Dylan's the funniest guy I know.
Yeah, and they tell stories and stuff, and it's just like this guy could like literally be doing panel on a talk show right now. He's like that level funny. So, I don't know, but I'm glad. I basically just kept playing drums. When I moved to New York, then I couldn't play because, you know, I lived in New York.
Yeah.
And I stopped playing for 5 years. Then I dated this chick, and I mentioned that I played. She always wanted to play, so I started teaching her, and it got me back into it. So then for like the last 15 years, I have been playing. But, you know, I played for the first, like, it wasn't until these like last couple of years I actually played out with other guys. And it finally dawned on me one day, going, dude, you've been sitting in like a practice room for like 15 fucking years. Like, isn't the point of this to interact with other humanity? So it's a really stand-up comic sort of loner way that I kind of went into it. But, you know, I'm kind of glad that I did wait that long because, you know, my talent was at the level it was. So it took me a long time just to get decent and to understand just even what the job of a drummer was, which was basically it doesn't make a difference what you're playing. If the people in the crowd are just standing there thinking about their taxes, you're not doing the fucking job. And then that's when I learned that by watching Steve Jordan and being like, because he would play really simple stuff and it gave you the chills. And I'm like, I can physically play that, but I can't make it sound anywhere as good as that. And that's when I kind of dawned on me. It's like, dude, you've kind of learned everything 65% and then moved on to the next thing. And that's why the whole thing sounds like a three-quarter bag of shit. So you got to go back and start over again. So I'm still in the process of doing that. But
what age did you start, Dave?
In the womb?
Yeah.
It's I was around music, you know, growing up. My parents used to go to parties, and there'd always be bands playing, and Latin jazz bands, you know, playing percussion. So, you know, I was always drawn to the drummers for some reason, and I would sit there and I just watch them. And there was a time where we were at this venue, and it was like a family, you know, dance party, whatever it was. I think it might have been New Year's or something, and I was sitting backstage, and my mom couldn't find me. I was probably 10 years old or something. She says, "There you are." I was sitting on the piano stool watching the band from stage left. She said, "Why don't you go outside? Why don't you go, you know, go to the front, dance with some girls? You know, there's a lot of kids running around." I said, "No, Mom, I want to stay right here." Yeah. And I was just watching the drummer. And that was one of the times. And there were several other times that we were at parties, and I was just fixated on what the drummer was doing and, you know, how they would hit.
Yeah.
You know, the passion that they would play, you know, with. And, you know, I think that taught me a lot, you know, just by watching these guys at a young age. And so then when I picked up drumsticks, I felt it kind of natural, you know, to do what they were doing.
You played Ludwig, right?
Now I'm back to Tama.
Oh, Tama.
Yeah.
You were on Ludwig for a while?
Yeah, for a couple few years.
Does it matter to you what drums you play? I mean, other than your sponsor, I'm saying.
Yeah, well...
Yeah, don't get him in trouble.
We can be honest here.
Because people go through phase. There was years where DW was the king.
Yeah.
And then I remember those the guy from Pearl Jam was playing those AOTs with the wooden fucking rims, that guy in Canada. And, you know, everybody was like, those were the drums, you know? And
I think, you know, I mean, for me, Tama withstands my hitting. You know, the way I hit, it tolerates it. It doesn't fall apart. Whereas, you know, maybe Ludwig, you know, they have some great shells, but the hardware, you know, doesn't take the abuse.
Right.
You know, things fall, you know, the stands break somehow, you know, and it's just, you know, I had a difficult time when I was with that company, but, you know, I mean, it's a great company, a great bunch of people, you know, great drums, but, you know, they need to work on some of their stuff. And Tama, for me, just is phenomenal. It just really... takes a beating.
You ever go to that pro drum shop, man? That place?
The one on Vine? Or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a fucking great store.
I haven't been there. I'd love to get there.
Oh, you got
to
get in there, dude. These guys...
One of the last times I went in there, they had Ed Shaughnessy's whole drum kit for sale there. And they still sounded great. He would get like two or three a year or something like that. And he used to put his initials on his cymbals. Like, they had the whole thing there. They had just some of the stuff. I can't even, like, some of the old kits. You remember those kits?
The one that with the tubes? Remember
well,
that?
Well, they did this thing where it almost looked like the drums were, like, deflated. Like, you took air out of it. Like, drums in like the 30s or
40s. Yeah, they got one there.
Yeah, an experimental.
It's incredible. Oh, it looks like it's melted.
Yes. Yeah, like it melted.
Yeah.
They got stuff like that. Somebody came in with like a full set of like vibes, like Lionel Hampton. Like you could literally go out with the Count Basie band level thing over in the corner. And like, you know, they got a lot of shit like that, that like, you know, people who aren't pros go in and just buy it for whatever fucking reason. Yeah. But other than that, they're cymbal selection, and it's an old school like music store where, you know, sometimes they'll have to order something, but they always have like a part. They got all kinds of just all kinds of bass drum pedals and all this stuff all over the place. It's insane.
It's an incredible store, and the people are so great there. They're not like jaded old like burnouts, you know, like
like Guitar Center.
Like, hey, do you got this? Eat a dick. You know, like, what? You don't work out. I mean, like, I remember first going to Guitar Center when I was young, man, and the guy would just have a mustache and long hair, and I'd be like, hey, that's a Gibson V. And he'd be like, yeah, it is. Get out of here, you fucking idiot. You'd be like, oh, he worked there.
Oh, yeah. No, they were brutal.
Well, they were brutal.
But
right?
Some guys were snobs. In the, like, there was a local music store when I first went in, and I remember I saw Stuart Copeland for the first time. So as a youngster, you think, oh, if I bought a splash cymbal, then I could play like him, you know, right? Yep. So I go in there, and I didn't know what it was called.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I want to buy a cymbal. It's like a little kind of, and I'm sitting there stammering, and there's all these fucking long-haired, cool people, and the guy just looks at me, and he goes, you mean a splash? I was just like, yeah. And I was so embarrassed that it took me until getting in my car. I was just like, wait, fuck you, what the fuck did I take that? Because just that whole thing, being an adult and not knowing something was still really embarrassing to me back then.
That's what the Comedy Store hallway felt like to me the first couple years. Like, I'd be in there, and like, you know, there'd be a couple comics, and I'd be like, hey, you guys going on? And they're like paid regulars, and they'd be like, who the fuck are you?
Yeah,
just look at me with like lasers and just melt me down. I just cruise away. Because I was so excited, like, this is a Comedy Store, man. You guys going on? You know? I was fucking brutal, man.
Now, do you guys get the same personalities as rock bands get? You know, these, let's say, comedians that think they're rock stars or act like rock stars?
Well, we don't have to, we tour individually, so we don't have to deal with it. A few times that I've gone out and done tours, back when I was early on, I did a couple of ones like Just for Laughs would have one, or you know, I did one that was on like a TV show, and then that was when I started to understand how difficult it is to be in a band where it wasn't just about me.
Yeah.
And the car leaves when I get there. It's like everybody's got to get there, and then I really, you know. Then I did a couple of those tours, and I started thinking, okay, there's always the late guy.
Oh.
There's the pussy hound or slash substance abuse guy.
Yeah.
There's the fucking egomaniac who's going to burn the light.
Yeah.
And it just starts being like, and you have to learn to tolerate certain shit and then know when to call people out, but not do it in a way that embarrasses them so the whole tour doesn't go to shit. And I was just really going like, can you imagine doing this in a fucking van year after year after year after year? And it gets to the point. I mean, it gets to the point, a lot of those big bands, they literally have their own tour buses and they still can't stand the sight of each other. Like, I don't even see his fucking bus.
It's crazy, right? Yeah, park his bus on the other side. I remember I saw a band, I won't say who they were, but the band buses were here, and then the lead singer's bus was here, and the lights went down, and he walked on here, and the band walked on this way, and they played, and they left that way. I was like, wow.
Yeah. That happens. Very common.
Yeah. And then you got to stay together because what am I going to start over again? It's like the money, you know? And you got to fucking. Dude, that happens with a lot of shit. It's like it's like this bad marriage, and you're staying together for the kids, and the kids is the cash.
Yeah.
And I've seen that. I've seen that happen with writing teams, radio shows, bands, just so much shit where people just. Like, we built this fucking thing, and now we're stuck. I mean, it's easy on the outside to look at it, but I would think at some point to just be like, listen, man, I mean, we're playing live. At some point, we got to shoot each other a look.
Yeah,
if
somebody's
a little lost. Like, how does that... Will that guy not help you? Have you been in a band situation? I don't want you to throw anybody under the bus, but have you been in a band situation where it's just like you're not even talking, and then you guys go out there and put the smiles on and...
No smiles. Yes, there has been situations. There's no smiles or snarls. You know, like
what's that like? Because you're like you're up there and you're going like this fucking guy. You know?
And it sucks. You know, it doesn't.
You guys don't have separate buses. You're not at that level.
No, it's not good for the creative process and for the performance, you know. But, you know, you get over it and you move on and, you know, things usually iron themselves out. And,
yeah.
And show
what's
must go
most,
on.
What's the most fucked up thing you've seen as far as a situation like that? You don't got to name the band or anything. Just as far as, like, you saw it and you're like, that band is going to break up within, like, 24 hours. And then maybe it happens and maybe it doesn't. What's the craziest thing you saw? Or something crazy.
Well, I've seen similar things like what you said where, you know, the bands are parked. You know, members of the band are parked in separate parts of the, or separate areas of the parking lot backstage. Or, you know, they don't even allow one of the musicians' bus to enter the backstage area. Let's say, you know, you're playing the Sheds. Oh, he could park outside with the opening acts.
Oh, man. Wow.
Yeah. So I've seen that. And of course, you know, the artist complains and, you know, you hear all this stuff going on backstage. So it's...
Oh, you're out of camera.
Oh, saying. Sorry.
Yeah. Wow, that's crazy, yeah. You know?
But, yeah, it happens, you know. And I've seen personalities and witness, you know, certain personalities. Ah, that guy's trouble. Yeah. Shit's going to go down. Give it a couple, few years and
oh, yeah.
Watch.
That's what you end up I can start doing that as a comedian. I've seen a few people. I'm like, oh, if that person gets their own show. Somewhere, beginning season two, mid-season
Monster
two.
Monster comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. They're going to fucking dress down a PA. then they're going to want a new director. And then the creators aren't going to be allowed on set. Like, you just see that, like, not, it's definitely going to happen, but you just sit there going, like, all right, you have just enough of that. Like, because what it is, you see somebody come in and they're super nice. Hey. Yeah. And then what it is when you see them just get just a little bit of status, just start getting spots.
So true.
And then immediately you see them. Start then at that point they've moved a little, so then now there's actually somebody beneath them, and then you see the way that they treat them.
Yes.
Either stop talking to them or just start being a dick, and you just feel like, oh, that's a snowball gathering snow, and the higher the more speed this thing gets, it's just gonna be it's gonna be a shit show. I've actually seen a couple in my lifetime in this business. I've watched a couple people literally become like a showbiz like doing cliched like shit, where you're just like, Jesus, dude, we used to make fun of that, like,
That's
you know when you talk about when you make it, you know the funny, the shit.
I'm gonna be the Adam Sandler, bring my crew.
I'm gonna dump my wife and have a fucking trophy wife, and I'll be smoking crack and blah. You just joke about the flame out, and then you start watching people doing that shit, just going like, what the, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Surround yourself with people. No, nobody says no. They're all looking up to you. Like, wow, you're awesome. Like, just that type of shit. Just going like, oh, man.
That's brutal, man. It's brutal. I seen it even back in the day playing music on a small level.
Oh, yeah.
Like, one band starts to get a bigger draw than you. And before, it was like a co-headlining. And then all of a sudden, it's like, well, you can't, you know, you guys can't use the drum riser tonight. We're like, what do you mean?
Like, dude, I love all that music shit.
We're fucking friends. We ate a burrito together. I know, but it's just kind of biz, you know. I mean, we got some A&R guys coming, and you know, we got to look like, you know, look a certain way. And you're like, dude, we're setting up on the floor in front of your drum riser now. You're on the stage with like 2 inches now, or your singer's on the right or left side of the drum kit. All looks wrong. It doesn't look rock at all, you know? That kind
of
shit.
I heard a story one time. It was one of those, you know, older bands were getting together.
Yeah.
And the two lead singers still had a rivalry. So the headliner guy, they had this long fucking runway that went all the way out into the crowd.
Yeah.
He said the opener guy couldn't use it. And it was this big dust up backstage.
Like, I heard of that.
Oh, yeah, the ego ramps.
I'm gonna be the guy that comes all the way out there. But you just stay back by the drummer, and you just look at, it's almost like two teams looking for a competitive edge.
Yeah.
And he was just like, yeah, you can't use that. And then the guy's like, what the fuck? And then the other guy's just like, well, it's our runway. You're using our fucking stage. And just like literally gets into that type of stuff. That's when you're just like, come on, man.
Yeah, I heard Stones did that to Skinnerd. They said, can't use the ego ramp. And they're like, yeah, all right, cool. And they got out there, and all three, on Freebird, fuck you, all the way out on the ego ramp, just rocking Freebird.
And was that the end of their run on the tour?
Probably was, but the thing was they crushed so hard that day. It was when they opened for them at like...
Which can also get you bounced.
Yeah.
You want to get the job done, don't do it too well.
Yeah. I remember I opened for a comic early on, and it was the first time I featured for a guy. I didn't really know him, and they had me open for him, and I went out I wanted to do great. He recommended me. And I came off and I was like, fuck, that crowd's great out there. And he's like, you leave any laughs out there for me? And I was like, yeah. He goes, no, fucking serious. What are you doing? Hammering him. I was like, oh, I had no idea of that coming in. I was like, I just wanted to do good for you. So you didn't look bad.
Dean brought the fire. He brought the fire that night.
Yeah, there was this one guy. I remember I was in transition. It was back in 92. I had left Slayer. And I was starting a new band, and I went to go see this band that was playing at this venue. And I meet up with the guys, you know, before the show, and the drummer, he starts giving me this list of everything they're doing. Oh, yeah, I was just at Ozzy's house. Ozzy made me breakfast, and we're going to be playing this festival and that festival and this festival.
Ozzy
and,
made me. And
that must have been horrible.
Yeah, right? And then he turns to me after, like, playing with his hair, what are you doing? Oh. You know, just like, really, so what have you been up to? And it's like, really?
Wow.
Really bad attitude.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Just trying to, he knew you were out of Slayer.
Yeah.
He's trying to rub it on you.
Yeah.
Insane.
So he tried to hit me up a couple years ago. I never answered him. You
know? Oh,
did you go, jam.
Did you go extra hard that show?
Well, I wasn't, I was in transition of forming a new band
at
that time. So that's why nothing was going on. It was a little hiatus. And, you know, so then he calls me or sends me a message a couple years back. I never answered him. I don't want nothing to do with you, dude. Yeah. I remember you clearly.
He's probably playing with his hair as he was sending the
email. He's like,
hey, man, if you know any gigs out there, let me know. You should have just hit him back. Matter of fact, I need a tech. What are you doing this summer?
Right?
Oh, man.
Hey, when you go out now, when you tour, how long, like back in the day, you guys would do like, year, 2 year runs, right?
Well, I mean, we would go on tour for about a month, you know, so we would do 4 shows, day off, 3 shows, day off, you know.
Jesus.
So, and then off for maybe a month and a half and then go back out for another month. So it's never a year straight.
Never
a year straight. Recently, I did a tour. I did 19 shows in 19 days.
Wow, which band?
With Film.
Oh, what a great band, this band, man.
Not anymore. I'm not with that band anymore.
Yeah. Oh, did you leave?
Yeah, basically.
What happened?
I'm not going to talk about it. They didn't want me to promote the band while I was with them, and I'm certainly not going to do it when I'm without them.
Wait, they don't want you to promote it while you're in the band? What kind of shoot yourself in the foot is that?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, so I just said, all right.
They don't say you in this band.
Yes, that's the anti-making it plan.
Yeah, that's it.
Let's stick to backyard parties. Don't mention we got gigs or nothing.
Oh, and don't play hard.
Oh,
I want you to play a little softer.
Wow. So you got a new band. Let's talk about it, because I know you got to get out of here. You're working on it right now today, a matter of fact.
Yeah, I'm heading over to Venice Beach. Ross Robinson is producing it. And it has Justin Pearson from Retox and The Locust, Gabe Serbian from Headwound City and The Locust. And Retox, and he was in Cattle Decapitation.
Yeah.
And he's on vocals.
Names are hilarious.
Yeah. Cattle Decapitation. Yeah.
And they're all vegans.
Wow. Oh my God. Just like vegan metal.
It's awesome. And they.
Oh my God.
And Michael Crane from Retox. These guys, they're do it yourself, underground, you know, punk rockers, you know.
Right.
It's brutal. The band's called Dead Cross, and it's heavy thrash in your face without any, you know, computer editing and all this fancy stuff. It's raw.
You guys are just recording it right there at Venice Beach at Ross's house?
Yes.
He's got an incredible setup there.
Yeah, he does.
Man, he's just got this like 4-story super loft right in by the Muscle Beach Park.
Oh, is this the guy I rode with?
Yeah.
That's cool.
His pad is incredible, and they get some magic out of there. Down in the guest house, he turned it into a full-blown studio, and it's just fire in there, man. That's where I first met you.
Yeah, he's a great motivator. He really,
he knows how to talk to you and get the most out of you, out of your performance, and really, you know, fires you up.
Yeah, he's pretty, he's like, I learned positive from him.
Yeah.
And Burr, too. I learned that. Like, Burr used to, I'd be like, ah, oh, fuck that. He'd go, eh, actually, I don't know. You got to look at this and that. Hey, yeah, you're wrong there. And I'd be like,
no, you got to train. If you're going to get, I think just in general, if you're going to succeed, you have to, if your brain is not where it needs to be, you're not going to get off the ground, because you're constantly going to just be like, no, people are going to be like, no, sorry, can't do it. And you have to be able to not let that just be like this albatross around your neck and just take it into this fucking depression. I mean, you know.
What year did that change for you, though? Because you were there for a long time. You were angry, right?
Yeah, I was. But I always had this weird sort of overall positive outlook, which is why when big shit happens, I don't flip. I flip out over little stuff. Like when they made these fucking, the tops of these water bottles smaller, the caps. I didn't understand why, and I couldn't. It became frustrating to open it. I would look, what the fuck are they doing, these cheap fucks? Then I found out it was like this environmental thing. Uh-huh. Then I'm like, but you still got the whole other bottle, the whole thing's bullshit. Like, that shit gets me going for whatever and drives my wife nuts. But like, I there was somewhere in like my 30s when, you know, when just the fallout of my anger just had reached this thing, and I was just kind of like going like, all right, I'm hitting 35. Most people live to be about 70. I'm kind of halfway through this on a good run. Am I really going to be the angry guy? Am I going to be angry the whole, you know? And a lot of that, you know, when I started coming out here more, and East Coast people, oh, you're going to lose your edge. You're going to lose your edge. And it's like, dude, I got plenty of that. I got plenty of that. I need to stick the toes in the sand here, decompress. So, yeah, it just became that. And then I fortunately was not a clinically depressed person. I just was susceptible to negative thought because there was a lot of that around me when I was growing up. So I was able to get myself out of it. So now I just sort of have like, I can kind of catch it when it's happening.
Right.
Where I just go like, okay, all right, you want to just think that for the rest of the fucking day, or you want to go to the gym, go down and try something new, cook something, like something that's going to get me in a good mood as opposed to, but I definitely had those years of laying on the futon, not writing jokes for fucking a month and just being like, oh, what am I doing? This sucks. Why'd that person get a break and I didn't? You know, I went through that shit. But I mean, fortunately, that was something that was only like, it was a short period.
I remember you told me something that stuck
with
me.
But people still think I'm angry because they watch my act. But
I remember you told me something. You said, look, man, you're going to probably make it and get somewhere. And you're going to have a fucking, you're really going to want to tell all those people that said no to you to fuck off. He's like, don't do that. Just go with it. You know, they said no at that time.
Because hopefully you won't care.
Yeah.
But there's the thing of this business is hard enough as it is. You don't need to be walking around. We go, let me tell you something, motherfucker.
Yeah.
Fucking back in 1990. Because they don't even remember.
Yeah. You closed the door on me.
And for all you know, they had some crisis going on in their home life that caused them to be short. Oh, or how about you weren't good enough?
Right,
at that point,
exactly.
You were starting out. So it's like, you know, I always tell guys that, like, because there was a guy that fucked me out of money early on in my career, and then he made some comment about my act, and it really, you know, and I was brand new, so I was like, you know, just totally wide open. I had no, you know, deflector shield, so it went right to the soul. And I just remember, I used to lay in bed at night thinking about it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And he's going to walk up to say hello, and I'm going to be like, listen, motherfucker. Fucking all this thing. It was like the F word. And I remembered I ended up getting something. I got a small acting part or whatever, and I was at the Laugh Factory.
Yeah.
And I ended up running into the guy. I hadn't seen him in years. And the guy walked by. He goes, hey, man, I heard about that. He's like, congratulations. And I wasn't even thinking. And I just, oh, hey, yeah, thanks a lot, blah, blah. And then he walked out. I remember after he walked out looking like, oh, that was the moment. That was the moment where I was like, you know what? I didn't give a shit. I don't care. This guy has no effect on my fucking life. He had an effect on my life. You know, he made one comment, and I allowed that to snowball. So we're like, even now when people do shit to me that like really like pisses me off or whatever, like I try to manage it down to like, Bill, you know, who gives a fuck?
Yeah.
Who gives a shit? Yeah, you're selling tickets. You're getting away with murder.
Yeah.
You're a working comedian. I mean, it's I'm stealing money. So there's only so upset I can get about shit like that.
Yeah. Well, congrats on F is for Family, man.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's so awesome. Check that out.
Yeah? Yes.
It's so fucking funny, man.
My daughter was the one. She goes, here, Dad, watch this. I said, Bill, I know him.
Really? Wow, this is great.
Your daughter watches it? Yeah. That's so great. How old is she?
She's 15.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
She gets it.
I did that, co-created with Mike Price from The Simpsons, and he was a guy that when we met him, like, we were just talking about childhood stories, and he just had the funniest stuff. And like, a lot of writers are really introverted, and he had this big personality, a booming laugh, and just, and like, he's a creative force. So now that the show's doing well, people keep going, hey, you created this show. I did it with Mike Price from The Simpsons. And, like, you know, I had, like, a seed of the idea, and then, like, he helped me flesh it out. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, and we got a killer writer's room and all of that. And it was basically when we were interviewing the writers, you know, if you had, like, a happy childhood and you, you know, parents who listened, we were like, all right, see you later. Somebody came up and was just like, yeah, we used to take out the family car, and my brother threw me down the stairs for no reason. You're like, all right, man,
that's it.
Send us a spec script. Let's see what you got. So for people, your listeners who haven't heard about it, it's on Netflix. There's 6 episodes, because when we came at them, I don't think they, you know, they were thinking, oh, comedian, he's going to do this type of show. And I told him I wanted to do a cartoon.
Yeah.
I think they were kind of like, that's kind of weird.
Yeah. I love it.
But fortunately,
I think it's great.
I got in business with Wild West, which is Vince Vaughn's people, and Vince came to the pitch meetings.
Yeah.
So as much as they were looking at, why is this dick joke comic want to do a cartoon, they keep looking over, that's an A-list movie star. Yeah. All right, we'll give you 6.
Yeah.
We'll see what you can do. Because a lot of people were asking, how come there wasn't 12? That's why, because I think that they wanted to see if we could execute it. And from what I'm hearing, it's doing well. Netflix does not have ratings, but we've been getting great feedback from them. So, you know, God willing, you know, I'll get the 2nd season. And if I don't, I won't go, you know what, fuck that whole fucking thing. I'm not going to do that. I'd be like, hey, you know, they were nice enough to give me 6. I get it. So
it's brilliant. It's hilarious. I love it.
I'm waiting for season 2 because I want to come in with that. Yeah, man. Hey, Murphy. I got to get my voice in there, man. I keep seeing Vic. I'm like, that's me, the neighbor, Vic. I love him. He's just like, hey, Murphy, look at this pussy I got right here and this big screen. You ain't got shit.
No. He roots for you.
Yeah.
He roots for you. That's the thing we had to make
it
like.
He does.
Like, he's just, when he finds out Frank has a bigger TV, he's like, all right, man, that's great. So Frank's really fighting this one-sided war. Sam Rockwell does the voice for that.
He's great on that.
Laura Dern does Sue Murphy, the wife, and Justin Long does Kevin. He's been crushing it. Haley Reinhart does me. It's just Dave Koechner, Gary Cole. There's just been a zillion people. Mo Collins does so many voices on it. It's awesome, man. I really hope we get to come back and do some more. But if we only got to do 6, I know we swung for the fences and people really like it.
They're fucking great. So, I'm telling you, man, it's the talk still right now, Comedy Store. A guy last night was talking to me about it. I go, dude, I watched them the first fucking day. You know, hey, are you watching? Yeah,
I
watched
I was psyched. Last night I went down to the Comedy Store and like a couple comics came up to me and said, hey, man, F is for Family is really funny. So you make a comedian laugh. I don't give a shit what level they're on. That's awesome, man. And
your temper on that show is amazing.
I had Koechner on.
Fuck! I mean, the first one, you're trying to hang up the phone. Fuck! And you're like...
I grew up around a lot of, like, big-hearted people that would give you the shirt off their back, and they had massive rage issues. And I think, aside from being dysfunctional, I think when you're the kind of guy that will give your shirt off your back, when you don't get that in return... That it's like, I think a lot of rage people have an issue with the lack of common courtesy with like their fellow man. Like I in traffic lose my fucking shit when somebody, you know, just makes a fucking move that blocks you and you have to wait until they're done with their move, and they easily could have just, if they just gave a fuck that you were behind there, they pull up a little bit and they don't. I'm always, you know, dude, when I'm the first guy to make a left at the red light, dude, like my responsibility, I feel, is not that the guy behind me, the two guys back.
The
I want 3 cars. That should be your fucking goal.
Yeah.
And traffic would move a lot better out here if people did that, but they don't. So I grew up around a lot of rage people, and I have it.
I get fucking furious on people that are late. It just makes me crazy because I'm always on time. I like to be professional. And you think I don't want to fucking sleep an extra hour? I do. But now I got up early, but you slept that extra hour, and now we're late to the fucking gig. Yep. And, you know, it makes me fucking steaming.
Absolutely.
Because I just want to be a pro, you know?
No, I just don't want to stand around waiting for some fucking guy.
No, no, that's it too. I'm like, really, man? And this is the worst when they text traffic. At what fucking time is there not traffic every fucking day? You can't use that as an excuse.
2 minutes away.
Yeah,
that means a half hour.
2 minutes away, I'm out front.
two minutes away.
Let's get out of here, man. Thanks, guys, for doing the podcast.
Yeah, no worries.
Awesome.
Welcome, man.
And we're going to put together this birthday bash, and you guys are going to play. We're going to do some AC/DC.
Let's do it.
Yeah,
it's going
to
be great.
I'm dying to see you getting up. You're going to front the band, right?
I front the band, dude.
I love it.
I front it strong. I come out, it's just Bond, full tilt.
That's
awesome. And then, you know, the last song is Night Prowler, and that song to me, it was funny. I was with Maren, and we were going to see the Stones, and we drove to San Diego, and he put on the Highway to Hell record. And I realize it's just a masterpiece, you know? And it gets that Night Prowler at the end, and then he's like, Shazbat, nanu, nanu. No.
Yeah.
And you're like, that fucking guy rules.
Yeah.
It really dates the album, too. You're like, all right, that's 1979.
Tells you right there. Morgue for morgue.
The fact that that was still okay to do that.
Yeah, right?
My OCD, I had to fucking untwist the cord there.
Looks good.
Thanks, guys, man. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Thank you, Dean.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.